It might have been an ordinary visit. Dr. Darrell introduced the young man as a cousin from across space, and interest was dulled by the cliché. Somehow, however, among the small talk, a name might be mentioned. There would be an easy thoughtfulness. Dr. Darrell might say no, or he might say yes. A call on the open communiwave issued a casual invitation, "One should meet my cousin." And Arcadia's preparations proceeded in their own manner. In fact, her actions might be considered the least straightforward of all. For instance, she induced Olynthus Dam at school to donate to her a home-built, self-contained sound receiver, by methods which indicated a future for her that promised peril to all males with whom she might come into contact. To avoid details, she merely exhibited such an interest in Olynthus's self-publicized hobby. He had a home workshop. Combined with such a well-modulated transfer of this interest to Olynthus's own pudgy features, that the unfortunate youth found himself, one, discoursing at great and animated length upon the principles of the hyperwave motor, two, becoming dizzyingly aware of the great, absorbed eyes that rested so lightly upon his, and three, forcing into her willing hands his own greatest creation, the aforesaid sound receiver. Arcadia cultivated Olynthus in diminishing degree thereafter, for just long enough to remove all suspicion that the sound receiver had been the cause of the friendship. For months afterwards, Olynthus felt the memory of that short period in his life, over and over again, with the tendrils of his mind, until finally, for lack of further addition, he gave up and let it slip away. When the seventh evening came, and five men sat in the Darrell living room with food within and tobacco without, Arcadia's desk upstairs was occupied by this quite unrecognizable home product of Olynthus's ingenuity. Five men, then. Dr. Darrell, of course, with graying hair and meticulous clothing, looking somewhat older than his 42 years. Peleus Anthor, serious and quick-eyed at the moment, looking young and unsure of himself. And the three new men. Joe Turbor, Visicaster, bulky and plump-lipped. Dr. Elvet Semek, professor emeritus of physics at the university, scrawny and wrinkled, his clothes only half-filled. Homer Munn, librarian, lanky and terribly ill at ease. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. And the three new men. Joe Turbor, Visicaster, bulky and plump-lipped. Dr. Elvet Semek, professor emeritus of physics at the university, scrawny and wrinkled, his clothes only half-filled. Homer Munn, librarian, lanky and terribly ill at ease. Dr. Darrell spoke easily, in a normal, matter-of-fact tone. This gathering has been arranged, gentlemen, for a trifle more than merely social reasons. You may have guessed this. Since you have been deliberately chosen because of your backgrounds, you may also guess the danger involved. I won't minimize it, but I will point out that we are all condemned men, in any case. You will notice that none of you have been invited with any attempt at secrecy. None of you have been asked to come here unseen. The windows are not adjusted to non-insight. No screen of any sort is about the room. We have only to attract the attention of the enemy to be ruined, and the best way to attract that attention is to assume a false and theatrical secrecy. Ha! Thought Arcadia, bending over the voices coming, a bit screechily, out of the little box. Do you understand that? Elvet Semek twitched his lower lip and bared his teeth in the screw-up, wrinkled gesture that preceded his every sentence. Oh, get on with it. Tell us about the youngster.
The best,
Dr. Darrell said. Peleus Anthor is his name. He was a student of my old colleague, Cleese, who died last year. Cleese sent me his brain pattern to the fifth sublevel before he died, which pattern has now been checked against that of the man before you. You know, of course, that a brain pattern cannot be duplicated that far, even by men of the science of psychology. If you don't know that, you'll have to take my word for it. Turbor said, purse-lipped, we might as well make a beginning somewheres. We'll take your word for it. Especially since you're the greatest electroneurologist in the galaxy, now that Cleese is dead. At least, that is the way I've described you in my Visicast comment, and I even believe it myself. How old are you, Anthor? 29, Mr. Turbor. And are you an electroneurologist, too? A great one? Just a student of the science, but I work hard, and I've had the benefit of Cleese's training. Munn broke in. He had a slight stammer at periods of tension. I wish you'd get started. I think everyone's talking too much. Dr. Darrell lifted an eyebrow in Munn's direction. You're right, Homer. Take over, Peleus. Not for a while, said Peleus Anthor slowly. Because before we can get started, although I appreciate Mr. Munn's sentiment, I must request brainwave data. Daryl frowned. What is this, Anthor? What brainwave data do you refer to? The patterns of all of you. You have taken mine, Dr. Daryl. I must take yours and those of the rest of you. And I must take the measurements myself. Turbor said, There's no reason for him to trust us, Daryl. The young man is within his rights. Thank you, said Anthor. If you'll lead the way to your laboratory, then, Dr. Daryl, we'll proceed. I took the liberty this morning of checking your apparatus. The science of electroencephalography was at once new and old. It was old in the sense that the knowledge of the microcircuits generated by nerve cells of living beings belonged to that immense category of human knowledge, whose origin was completely lost. It was knowledge that stretched back as far as the earliest remnants of human history, and yet it was new, too. The fact of the existence of microcurrents slumbered through the tens of thousands of years of galactic empire as one of those vivid and whimsical but quite useless items of human knowledge. Some had attempted to form classifications of waves into waking and sleeping, calm and excited, well and ill, but even the broadest conceptions had had their hordes of vitiating exceptions. Others had tried to show the existence of brainwave groups, analogous to the well-known blood groups, and to show that external environment was the defining factor. These were the race-minded people who claimed that man could be divided into subspecies. But such a philosophy could make no headway against the overwhelming ecumenical drive involved in the fact of galactic empire, one political unit covering 20 million stellar systems, involving all of man from the central world of Trantor, now a gorgeous and impossible memory of the great past, to the loneliest asteroid on the periphery. And then again, in a society given over, as that of the First Empire was, to the physical sciences and inanimate technology, there was a vague but mighty sociological push away from the study of the mind. It was less respectable because less immediately useful. It was poorly financed since it was less profitable. After the disintegration of the First Empire, there came the fragmentation of organized science, back, past even the fundamentals of atomic power, into the chemical power of coal and oil. The one exception to this, of course, was the First Foundation, where the spark of science, revitalized and grown more intense, was maintained and fed to flame. Yet there, too, it was the physical that ruled, and the brain, except for surgery, was neglected ground. Harry Seldon was the first to express what afterwards came to be accepted as truth. Neural microcurrents, he said once, carry within them the spark of every varying impulse and response, conscious and unconscious. The brainwaves, recorded on neatly squared paper in trembling peaks and troughs, are the mirrors of the combined thought pulses of billions of cells. Theoretically, analysis should reveal the thoughts and emotions of the subject, to the last and least. Differences should be detected that are due not only to gross physical defects, inherited or acquired, but also to shifting states of emotion, to advancing education and experience, even to something as subtle as a change in the subject's philosophy of life. But even Seldon could approach no further than speculation. And now for 50 years, the men of the First Foundation had been tearing at that incredibly vast and complicated storehouse of new knowledge. The approach, naturally, was made through new techniques, as, for example, the use of electrodes at skull sutures by a newly developed means which enabled contact to be made directly with the gray cells, without even the necessity of shaving a patch of skull. And then there was a recording device which automatically recorded the brainwave data as an overall total and as separate functions of 6 independent variables. What was most significant, perhaps, was the growing respect in which encephalography and the encephalographer was held. Cleese, the greatest of them, sat at scientific conventions on an equal basis with the physicist. Dr. Daryl, though no longer active in the science, was known for his brilliant advances in encephalographic analysis, almost as much as for the fact that he was the son of Beta Daryl, the great heroine of the past generation. And so now, Dr. Daryl sat in his own chair, with the delicate touch of the feathery electrodes scarcely hinting at pressure upon his skull, while the vacuum-encased needles wavered to and fro. His back was to the recorder. Otherwise, as was well known, the sight of the moving curves induced an unconscious effort to control them, with noticeable results. But he knew that the central dial was expressing the strongly rhythmic and little varying sigma curve, which was to be expected of his own powerful and disciplined mind. It would be strengthened and purified in the subsidiary dial dealing with the cerebellar wave. There would be the sharp, near-discontinuous leaps from the frontal lobe, and the subdued shakiness from the subsurface regions with its narrow range of frequencies. He knew his own brainwave pattern, much as an artist might be perfectly aware of the color of his eyes. Peleus Anthor made no comment when Daryl rose from the reclining chair. The young man abstracted the 7 recordings, glanced at them with the quick, all-embracing eyes of one who knows exactly what tiny facet of near-nothingness is being looked for. "If you don't mind, Dr. Semmick?" Semmick's age-yellowed face was serious. Electroencephalography was a science of his old age, of which he knew little, an upstart that he faintly resented. He knew that he was old, and that his wave pattern would show it. The wrinkles on his face showed it, the stoop in his walk, the shaking of his hand, but they spoke only of his body. The brainwave patterns might show that his mind was old, too. An embarrassing and unwarranted invasion of a man's last protecting stronghold, his own mind. The electrodes were adjusted. The process did not hurt, of course, from beginning to end. There was just that tiny tingle, far below the threshold of sensation. And then came Terbor, who sat quietly and unemotionally through the 15-minute process, and Munn, who jerked at the first touch of the electrodes, and then spent the session rolling his eyes, as though he wished he could turn them backwards, and watch through a hole in his occiput. "And now," said Daryl, when all was done. "And now," said Anthor apologetically, "there is one more person in the house." Daryl, frowning, said, "My daughter?" "Yes. I suggested that she stay home tonight, if you'll remember." "For encephalographical analysis? What in the galaxy for?" "I cannot proceed without it." Daryl shrugged and climbed the stairs. Arcadia, amply warned, had the sound receiver off when he entered, then followed him down with mild obedience. It was the first time in her life, except for the taking of her basic mind pattern as an infant, for identification and registration purposes, that she found herself under the electrodes. "May I see?" she asked, when it was over, holding out her hand. Dr. Daryl said, "You would not understand, Arcadia. Isn't it time for you to go to bed?" "Yes, father," she said demurely. "Good night, all." She ran up the stairs and plumped into bed with a minimum of basic preparation. With Olynthus's sound receiver propped beside her pillow, she felt like a character out of a book film, and hugged every moment of it close to her chest in an ecstasy of spy stuff. The first words she heard were Anthor's, and they were, "The analyses, gentlemen, are all satisfactory. The child as well." "Child," she thought disgustedly, and bristled at Anthor in the darkness. Anthor had opened his briefcase now, and out of it he took several dozen brainwave records. They were not originals, nor had the briefcase been fitted with an ordinary lock. Had the key been held in any other hand than his, the contents thereof would have silently and instantly oxidized into an indecipherable ash. Once removed from the briefcase, the records did so anyway, after half an hour. But during their short lifetime, Anthor spoke quickly. "I have the records here of several minor government officials at Anacreon. This is a psychologist at Locris University. This is an industrialist at Suena. The rest are as you see." They crowded closely. To all but Daryl, they were so many quivers on parchment. To Daryl, they shouted with a million tongues. Anthor pointed lightly. "I call your attention, Dr. Daryl, to the plateau region among the secondary Tauian waves in the frontal lobe, which is what all these records have in common. Would you use my analytical rule, sir, to check my statement?" The analytical rule might be considered a distant relation, as a skyscraper is to a shack, of that kindergarten toy, the logarithmic slide rule. Daryl used it with the wrist flip of long practice. He made freehand drawings of the result, and, as Anthor stated, there were featureless plateaus in frontal lobe regions where strong swings should have been expected. "How would you interpret that, Dr. Daryl?" asked Anthor. "I'm not sure. Offhand, I don't see how it's possible. Even in cases of amnesia, there is suppression, but not removal. Drastic brain surgery, perhaps?" "Oh, something's been cut out," cried Anthor impatiently. "Yes, not in the physical sense, however. You know, the mule could have done just that. He could have suppressed completely all capacity for a certain emotion or attitude of mind, and leave nothing but just such a flatness. Or else, Or else the Second Foundation could have done it, is that it? Asked Terbor with a slow smile. There was no real need to answer that thoroughly rhetorical question. What made you suspicious, Mr. Anthor? Asked Munn. It wasn't I. It was Dr. Cleese. He collected brainwave patterns, much as the planetary police do, but along different lines. He specialized in intellectuals, government officials, and business leaders. You see, it's quite obvious that if the Second Foundation is directing the historical course of the galaxy, of us, that they must do it subtly and in as minimal a fashion as possible. If they work through minds, as they must, it is the minds of people with influence, culturally, industrially, or politically, and with those he concerned himself. Yes, objected Munn, but is there corroboration? How do these people act? I mean the ones with the plateau. Maybe it's all a perfectly normal phenomenon. He looked hopelessly at the others out of his, somehow childlike blue eyes, but met no encouraging in return. I leave that to Dr. Darrell, said Anthor. Ask him how many times he's seen this phenomenon in his general studies, or in reported cases in the literature over the past generation. Then ask him the chances of it being discovered in almost 1 out of every 1,000 cases among the categories Dr. Cleese studied. I suppose that there is no doubt, said Darrell thoughtfully, that these are artificial mentalities. They have been tampered with. In a way, I have suspected this. I know that, Dr. Darrell, said Anthor. I also know you once worked with Dr. Cleese. I would like to know why you stopped. There wasn't actually hostility in his question, perhaps nothing more than caution, but at any rate, it resulted in a long pause. Darrell looked from one to another of his guests, then said brusquely, Because there was no point to Cleese's battle. He was competing with an adversary too strong for him. He was detecting what we, he and I, knew he would detect, that we were not our own masters. And I didn't want to know. I had my self-respect. I like to think that our foundation was captain of its collective soul, that our forefathers had not quite fought and died for nothing. I thought it would be most simple to turn my face away as long as I was not quite sure. I didn't need my position since the government pension awarded to my mother's family in perpetuity would take care of my uncomplicated needs. My home laboratory would suffice to keep boredom away, and life would someday end. Then Cleese died. Semmick showed his teeth and said, This fellow Cleese, I don't know him. How did he die? Anthor cut in. He died. He thought he would. He told me half a year before that he was getting too close. Now we're too close too, aren't we? Suggested Munn, dry-mouthed, as his Adam's apple jiggled. Yes, said Anthor flatly. But we were anyway, all of us. It's why you've all been chosen. I'm Cleese's student. Dr. Darrell was his colleague. Joel Terbor has been denouncing our blind faith in the saving hand of the Second Foundation on the air until the government shut him off, through the agency I might mention of a powerful financier whose brain shows what Cleese used to call the Tamper Plateau. Homer Munn has the largest home collection of Muliana, if I may use the phrase to signify collected data concerning the mule, in existence, and has published some papers concerning speculation on the nature and function of the Second Foundation. Dr. Semmick has contributed as much as anyone to the mathematics of encephalographic analysis, though I don't believe he realized that his mathematics could be so applied. Semmick opened his eyes wide and chuckled gaspingly. No, young fellow, I was analyzing intranuclear motions, the N-body problem, you know. I'm lost in encephalography. Then we know where we stand. The government can, of course, do nothing about the matter. Whether the mayor or anyone in his administration is aware of the seriousness of the situation, I don't know. But this I do know. We five have nothing to lose and stand to gain much. With every increase in our knowledge, we can widen ourselves in safe directions. We are but a beginning, you understand. How widespread, put in Terbor, is this Second Foundation infiltration? I don't know. There's a flat answer. All the infiltrations we have discovered were on the outer fringes of the nation. The capital world may yet be clean, though even that is not certain, else I would not have tested you. You were particularly suspicious, Dr. Darrell, since you abandoned research with Cleese. Cleese never forgave you, you know. I thought that perhaps the Second Foundation had corrupted you, but Cleese always insisted that you were a coward. You'll forgive me, Dr. Darrell, if I explain this to make my own position clear. I personally think I understand your attitude. and if it was cowardice, I consider it venial. Darrell drew a breath before replying. I ran away. Call it what you wish. I tried to maintain our friendship, however, yet he never wrote nor called me until the day he sent me your brainwave data, and that was scarcely a week before he died. If you don't mind, interrupted Homer Munn with a flash of nervous eloquence, I don't see what you think you're doing. We're a poor bunch of conspirators if we're just going to talk and talk and talk, and I don't see what else we can do anyway. This is very childish. Brainwaves and mumbo-jumbo and all that. Is there just one thing you intend to do? Peleus Anthor's eyes were bright. Yes, there is. We need more information on the Second Foundation. It's the prime necessity. The Mule spent the first 5 years of his rule in just that quest for information, and failed, or so we have all been led to believe. But then he stopped looking. Why? Because he failed, or because he succeeded? More talk, said Munn bitterly. How are we ever to know? If you'll listen to me. The Mule's capital was on Calgan. Calgan was not part of the Foundation's commercial sphere of influence before the Mule, and it is not part of it now. Calgan is ruled at the moment by the man Stettin, unless there's another palace revolution by tomorrow. Stettin calls himself First Citizen, and considers himself the successor of the Mule. If there is any tradition in that world, it rests with the superhumanity and greatness of the Mule, a tradition almost superstitious in intensity. As a result, the Mule's old palace is maintained as a shrine. No unauthorized person may enter. Nothing within has ever been touched. Well? Well, why is that so? At times like these, nothing happens without a reason. What if it is not superstition only that makes the Mule's palace inviolate? What if the Second Foundation has so arranged matters? In short, what if the results of the Mule's 5-year search are within... Oh, poppycock! Why not? Demanded Anthor. Throughout its history, the Second Foundation has hidden itself and interfered in galactic affairs in minimal fashion only. I know that to us it would seem more logical to destroy the palace, or at the least, to remove the data. But you must consider the psychology of these master psychologists. They are Seldons. They are Mules, and they work by indirection through the mind. They would never destroy or remove when they could achieve their ends by creating a state of mind. Huh? No immediate answer, and Anthor continued. And you, Munn, are just the one to get the information we need. I? It was an astounded yell. Munn looked from one to the other rapidly. I can't do such a thing. I'm no man of action, no hero of any teleview. I'm a librarian. If I can help you that way, all right, and I'll risk the Second Foundation, but I'm not going out into space on any quixotic thing like that. Now look, said Anthor patiently. Dr. Darrell and I have both agreed that you're the man. It's the only way to do it naturally. You say you're a librarian. Fine. What is your main field of interest? Muleana. You already have the greatest collection of material on the Mule in the galaxy. It is natural for you to want more. More natural for you than for anyone else. You could request entrance to the Calgan Palace without arousing suspicion of ulterior motives. You might be refused, but you would not be suspected. What's more, you have a one-man cruiser. You're known to have visited foreign planets during your annual vacation. You've even been on Calgan before. Don't you understand that you need only act as you always have? But I can't just say, won't you kindly let me into your most sacred shrine, Mr. First Citizen? Why not? Because, by the galaxy, he won't let me. All right, then, so he won't. Then you'll come home and we'll think of something else. Munn looked about in helpless rebellion. He felt himself being talked into something he hated. No one offered to help him extricate himself. So, in the end, two decisions were made in Dr. Darrell's house. The first was a reluctant one of agreement on the part of Munn to take off into space as soon as his summer vacation began. The other was a highly unauthorized decision on the part of a thoroughly unofficial member of the gathering, made as she clicked off a sound receiver and composed herself for a belated sleep. This second decision does not concern us just yet. Chapter 10, Approaching Crisis. A week had passed on the second foundation, and the first speaker was smiling once again upon the student. "You must have brought me interesting results, or you would not be so filled with anger." The student put his hand upon the sheaf of calculating paper he had brought with him and said, "Are you sure that the problem is a factual one?" "The premises are true. I have distorted nothing." "Then I must accept the results, and I do not want to." "Naturally. But what have your wants to do with it?" "Well, tell me what disturbs you so." "No, no. Put your derivations to one side. I will subject them to analysis afterward. Meanwhile, talk to me. Let me judge your understanding." "Well then, Speaker, it becomes very apparent that a gross overall change in the basic psychology of the First Foundation has taken place. As long as they knew of the existence of a Selden plan, without knowing any of the details thereof, they were confident but uncertain. They knew they would succeed, but they didn't know when or how. There was, therefore, a continuous atmosphere of tension and strain, which was what Selden desired. The First Foundation, in other words, could be counted upon to work at maximum potential." "A doubtful metaphor," said the first speaker, "but I understand you. But now, Speaker, they know of the existence of a second foundation in what amounts to detail, rather merely than as an ancient and vague statement of Selden's. They have an inkling as to its function as the guardian of the plan. They know that an agency exists which watches their every step and will not let them fall. So they abandon their purposeful stride and allow themselves to be carried upon a litter. Another metaphor, I'm afraid. Nevertheless, go on." "And that very abandonment of effort, that growing inertia, that lapse into softness and into a decadent and hedonistic culture, means the ruin of the plan. They must be self-propelled." "Is that all?" "No, there is more. The majority reaction is as described. But a great probability exists for a minority reaction. Knowledge of our guardianship and our control will rouse among a few, not complacence, but hostility. This follows from Korolev's theorem." "Yes, yes, I know the theorem. I'm sorry, Speaker. It is difficult to avoid mathematics. In any case, the effect is that not only is the Foundation's effort diluted, but part of it is turned against us, actively against us." "And is that all?" "There remains one other factor of which the probability is moderately low." "Very good. What is that?" "While the energies of the First Foundation were directed only to Empire, while their only enemies were huge and outmoded hulks that remained from the shambles of the past, they were obviously concerned only with the physical sciences. With us forming a new large part of their environment, a change in view may well be imposed upon them. They may try to become psychologists." "That change," said the first speaker coolly, "has already taken place." The student's lips compressed themselves into a pale line. "Then all is over. It is the basic incompatibility with the plan. Speaker, would I have known of this if I had lived outside?" The first speaker spoke seriously. "You feel humiliated, my young man, because, thinking you understood so much so well, you suddenly find that many very apparent things were unknown to you. Thinking you were one of the lords of the galaxy, you suddenly find that you stand near to destruction. Naturally, you will resent the ivory tower in which you lived, the seclusion in which you were educated, the theories on which you were reared. I once had that feeling. It is normal. Yet it was necessary that in your formative years you have no direct contact with the galaxy, that you remain here, where all knowledge is filtered to you and your mind carefully sharpened. We could have shown you this part failure of the plan earlier and spared you the shock now, but you would not have understood the significance properly, as you now will. Then you find no solution at all to the problem." The student shook his head and said hopelessly, "None." "Well, it is not surprising. Listen to me, young man. A course of action exists and has been followed for over a decade. It is not a usual course, but one that we have been forced into against our will. It involves low probabilities, dangerous assumptions. We have even been forced to deal with individual reactions at times, because that was the only possible way. And you know that psychostatistics by its very nature has no meaning when applied to less than planetary numbers. Are we succeeding? Gasped the student. There is no way of telling yet. We have kept the situation stable so far, but for the first time in the history of the plan, it is possible for the unexpected actions of a single individual to destroy it. We have adjusted a minimum number of outsiders to a needful state of mind. We have our agents, but their paths are planned. They dare not improvise. That should be obvious to you. And I will not conceal the worst. If we are discovered here, on this world, it will not only be the plan that is destroyed, but ourselves, our physical selves. So you see, our solution is not very good. But the little you have described does not sound like a solution at all, but like a desperate guess. No, let us say, an intelligent guess. When is the crisis, Speaker? When will we know whether we have succeeded or not? Well within the year, no doubt. The student considered that, then nodded his head. He shook hands with the Speaker. Well, it's good to know. He turned on his heel and left. The first speaker looked out silently as the window gained transparency, past the giant structures to the quiet, crowding stars. A year would pass quickly. Would any of them, any of Selden's heritage, be alive at its end? Chapter 11. Stowaway. It was a little over a month before the summer could said to have started. Started, that is, to the extent that Homier Munn had written his final financial report of the fiscal year, seeing to it that the substitute librarian supplied by the government was sufficiently aware of the subtleties of the post. Last year's man had been quite unsatisfactory, and arranged to have his little cruiser, the Unimara, named after a tender and mysterious episode of 20 years past, taken out of its winter cobwebbery. He left Terminus in a sullen distemper. No one was at the port to see him off. That would not have been natural, since no one ever had in the past. He knew very well that it was important to have this trip in no way different from any he had made in the past, yet he felt drenched in a vague resentment. He, Homier Munn, was risking his neck in daring duery of the most outrageous sort, and yet he left alone. At least, so he thought. And it was because he thought wrongly that the following day was one of confusion, both on the Unimara and in Dr. Darrell's suburban home. This book is continued on cassette number 5. And it was because he thought wrongly that the following day was one of confusion, both on the Unimara and in Dr. Darrell's suburban home. It hit Dr. Darrell's home first, in point of time, through the medium of Polly, the maid, whose month's vacation was now quite a thing of the past. She flew down the stairs in a flurry and stutter. The good doctor met her, and she tried vainly to put emotion into words, but ended by thrusting a sheet of paper and a cubical object at him. He took them unwillingly and said, "What's wrong, Polly?"
"She's gone, doctor."
"Who's gone?"
"Arcadia!"
"What do you mean, gone? Gone where? What are you talking about?" And she stamped her foot.
"I don't know. She's gone. And there's a suitcase and some clothes gone with her, and there's that letter. Why don't you read it instead of just standing there? Oh, you man!"
Dr. Darrell shrugged and opened the envelope. The letter was not long, and except for the angular signature, Arcady, was in the ornate and flowering handwriting of Arcadia's transcriber. "Dear Father, it would have been simply too heartbreaking to say goodbye to you in person. I might have cried like a little girl, and you would have been ashamed of me. So I'm writing a letter instead to tell you how much I'll miss you, even while I'm having this perfectly wonderful summer vacation with Uncle Homier. I'll take good care of myself, and it won't be long before I'm home again. Meanwhile, I'm leaving you something that's all my own. You can have it now. Your loving daughter, Arcady." He read it through several times, with an expression that grew blanker each time. He said stiffly, "Have you read this, Polly?" Polly was instantly on the defensive.
"I certainly can't be blamed for that, doctor. The envelope has Polly written on the outside, and I had no way of telling there was a letter for you on the inside. I'm no snoop, doctor, and in the years I've been with..."
Darrell held up a placating hand. "Very well, Polly. It's not important.
I just wanted to make sure you understood what had happened. He was considering rapidly. It was no use telling her to forget the matter. With regard to the enemy, forget was a meaningless word. And the advice, insofar as it made the matter more important, would have had the opposite effect. He said instead, "She's a queer little girl, you know. Very romantic. Ever since we arranged to have her go off on a space trip this summer, she's been quite excited." "And just why has no one told me about this space trip?" "It was arranged while you were away, and we forgot. It's nothing more complicated than that." Polly's original emotions now concentrated themselves into a single, overwhelming indignation. "Simple, is it? The poor chick has gone off with one suitcase, without a decent stitch of clothes to her, and alone at that. How long will she be away?" "Now, I won't have you worrying about it, Polly. There will be plenty of clothes for her on the ship. It's been all arranged. Will you tell Mr. Anthor that I want to see him? Oh, and first, is this the object that Arcadia has left for me?" He turned it over in his hand. Polly tossed her head. "I'm sure I don't know. The letter was on top of it, and that's every bit I can tell you." "Forget to tell me, indeed. If her mother were alive..." Daryl waved her away. "Please call Mr. Anthor." Anthor's viewpoint on the matter differed radically from that of Arcadia's father. He punctuated his initial remarks with clenched fists and torn hair, and from there passed on to bitterness. "Great space, what are you waiting for? What are we both waiting for? Get the spaceport on the viewer and have them contact the Unimera." "Softly, Peleus. She's my daughter." "It's not your galaxy. Now wait. She's an intelligent girl, Peleus, and she's thought this thing out carefully. We had better follow her thoughts while this thing is fresh. Do you know what this thing is?" "No. Why should it matter what it is?" "Because it's a sound receiver." "That thing? It's homemade, but it will work. I've tested it. Don't you see? It's her way of telling us that she's been a party to our conversations of policy. She knows where Homer Munn is going and why. She's decided it would be exciting to go along." "Oh, great space," groaned the younger man. "Another mine for the Second Foundation to pick. Except that there's no reason why the Second Foundation should, a priori, suspect a 14-year-old girl of being a danger. Unless we do anything to attract attention to her, such as calling back a ship out of space for no reason other than to take her off. Do you forget whom we're dealing with? How narrow the margin is that separates us from discovery? How helpless we are thereafter? But we can't have everything depend on an insane child. She's not insane, and we have no choice. She need not have written the letter, but she did it to keep us from going to the police after a lost child. Her letter suggests that we convert the entire matter into a friendly offer on the part of Munn to take an old friend's daughter off for a short vacation. And why not? He's been my friend for nearly 20 years. He's known her since she was 3 when I brought her back from Trantor. It's a perfectly natural thing, and in fact, ought to decrease suspicion. A spy does not carry a 14-year-old niece about with him. So, and what will Munn do when he finds her?" Dr. Daryl heaved his eyebrows once. "I can't say, but I presume she'll handle him." But the house was somehow very lonely at night, and Dr. Daryl found that the fate of the galaxy made remarkably little difference while his daughter's mad little life was in danger. The excitement on the Unimera, if involving fewer people, was considerably more intense. In the luggage compartment, Arcadia found herself, in the first place, aided by experience, and in the second, hampered by the reverse. Thus she met the initial acceleration with equanimity, and the more subtle nausea that accompanied the inside-outness of the first jump through hyperspace with stoicism. Both had been experienced on space hops before, and she was tensed for them. She knew also that luggage compartments were included in the ship's ventilation system, and that they could even be bathed in wall light. This last, however, she excluded as being too unconscionably unromantic. She remained in the dark, as a conspirator should, breathing very softly, and listening to the little miscellany of noises that surrounded Homer Munn. They were undistinguished noises, the kind made by a man alone. The shuffling of shoes, the rustle of fabric against metal, the soughing of an upholstered chair seat retreating under weight, the sharp click of a control unit, or the soft slap of a palm over a photoelectric cell. Yet eventually it was the lack of experience that caught up with Arcadia. In the book films and on the videos, the stowaways seemed to have such an infinite capacity for obscurity. Of course, there was always the danger of dislodging something which would fall with a crash, or of sneezing. In videos, you were almost sure to sneeze. It was an accepted matter. She knew all this, and was careful. There was also the realization that thirst and hunger might be encountered. For this, she was prepared with ration cans out of the pantry. But yet things remained that the films never mentioned, and it dawned upon Arcadia with a shock that, despite the best intentions in the world, she could stay hidden in the closet for only a limited time. And on a one-man sports cruiser, such as the Unimera, living space consisted, essentially, of a single room, so that there wasn't even the risky possibility of sneaking out of the compartment while Munn was engaged somewhere else. She waited frantically for the sounds of sleep to arise. If only she knew whether he snored. At least she knew where the bunk was, and she could recognize the rolling protest of one when she heard it. There was a long breath and then a yawn. She waited through a gathering silence, punctuated by the bunk's soft protest against a changed position or a shifted leg. The door of the luggage compartment opened easily at the pressure of her finger and her craning neck. There was a definite human sound that broke off sharply. Arcadia solidified. Silence. Still silence. She tried to poke her eyes outside the door without moving her head and failed. The head followed the eyes. Homer Munn was awake, of course, reading in bed, bathed in the soft, unspreading bedlight, staring into the darkness with wide eyes, and groping one hand stealthily under the pillow. Arcadia's head moved sharply back on itself. Then the light went out entirely, and Munn's voice said with shaky sharpness, "I've got a blaster, and I'm shooting by the galaxy." And Arcadia wailed, "It's only me, don't shoot!" Remarkable what a fragile flower romance is. A gun with a nervous operator behind it can spoil the whole thing. The light was back on, all over the ship, and Munn was sitting up in bed, the somewhat grizzled hair on his thin chest and the sparse one-day growth on his chin lent him an entirely fallacious appearance of disreputability. Arcadia stepped out, yanking at her Medellin jacket, which was supposed to be guaranteed wrinkle-proof. After a wild moment in which he almost jumped out of bed, but remembered, and instead yanked the sheet up to his shoulders, Munn gargled,
What?
He was completely incomprehensible. Arcadia said meekly, "Would you excuse me for a minute? I've got to go wash my hands." She knew the geography of the vessel and slipped away quickly. When she returned, with her courage oozing back, Homer Munn was standing before her with a faded bathrobe on the outside and a brilliant fury on the inside.
"What the black holes of space are you doing aboard this ship? How did you get here? What do you think I'm supposed to do with you? What's going on here?"
He might have asked questions indefinitely, but Arcadia interrupted sweetly. "I just wanted to come along, Uncle Homer."
"Why? I'm not going anywhere."
"You're going to Calgan for information about the Second Foundation." And Munn let out a wild howl and collapsed completely. For one horrified moment, Arcadia thought he would have hysterics or beat his head against the wall. He was still holding the blaster, and her stomach grew ice cold as she watched it. "Watch out, take it easy," was all she could think of to say. But he struggled back to relative normality and threw the blaster onto the bunk with a force that should have set it off and blown a hole through the ship's hull.
"How did you get on?" he asked slowly, as though gripping each word with his teeth very carefully to prevent it from trembling before letting it out.
"It was easy. I just came into the hangar with my suitcase and said, 'Mr. Munn's baggage,' and the man in charge just waved his thumb without even looking up."
"I'll have to take you back, you know," said Homer, and there was a sudden wild glee within him at the thought. "By space, this wasn't his fault."
"You can't," said Arcadia calmly. "It would attract attention."
"What?"
"You know. The whole purpose of your going to Calgan was because it was natural for you to go and ask permission to look into the mule's records. And you've got to be natural so that you attract no attention at all. If you go back with a girl stowaway, it might even get into the telenews reports."
"Where did you get those notions about Calgan? These are childish..."
He was far too flippant for conviction, of course, even to one who knew less than did Arcadia. "I heard," she couldn't avoid pride completely, "with a sound recorder. I know all about it. So you've got to let me come along. What about your father? He played a quick trump. For all he knows, you're kidnapped. Dead. I left a note, she said, over-trumping. And he probably knows he mustn't make a fuss or anything. You'll probably get a spacegram from him. To Munn, the only explanation was sorcery, because the receiving signal sounded wildly 2 seconds after she finished. She said, "That's my father, I bet." And it was. The message wasn't long, and it was addressed to Arcadia. It said, "Thank you for your lovely present, which I'm sure you put to good use. Have a good time." "You see," she said, "that's instructions." Homier grew used to her. After a while, he was glad she was there. Eventually, he wondered how he would have made it without her. She prattled, she was excited. Most of all, she was completely unconcerned. She knew the Second Foundation was the enemy, yet it didn't bother her. She knew that on Kalgan, he was to deal with a hostile officialdom, but she could hardly wait. Maybe it came of being 14. At any rate, the week-long trip now meant conversation rather than introspection. To be sure, it wasn't a very enlightening conversation, since it concerned almost entirely the girl's notions on the subject of how best to treat the Lord of Kalgan. Amusing and nonsensical, and yet delivered with weighty deliberation. Homier found himself actually capable of smiling as he listened and wondered out of just which gem of historical fiction she got her twisted notion of the great universe. It was the evening before the last jump. Kalgan was a bright star in the scarcely twinkling emptiness of the outer reaches of the galaxy. The ship's telescope made it a sparkling blob of barely perceptible diameter. Arcadia sat cross-legged in the good chair. She was wearing a pair of slacks and a none-too-roomy shirt that belonged to Homier. Her own more feminine wardrobe had been washed and ironed for the landing. She said, "I'm going to write historical novels, you know." She was quite happy about the trip. Uncle Homier didn't the least mind listening to her, and it made conversation so much more pleasant when you could talk to a really intelligent person who was serious about what you said. She continued, "I've read books and books about all the great men of Foundation history. You know, like Selden, Hardin, Mallow, Devers, and all the rest. I've even read most of what you've written about the mule, except that it isn't much fun to read those parts where the Foundation loses. Wouldn't you rather read a history where they skipped all the silly, tragic parts?" "Yes, I would," Munn assured her gravely. "But it wouldn't be a fair history, would it, Arcady? You'd never get academic respect unless you give the whole story." "Oh, poof, who cares about academic respect?" She found him delightful. He hadn't missed calling her Arcady for days. "My novels are going to be interesting and are going to sell and be famous. What's the use of writing books unless you sell them and become well-known? I don't want just some old professors to know me. It's got to be everybody." Her eyes darkened with pleasure at the thought, and she wriggled into a more comfortable position. "In fact, as soon as I can get Father to let me, I'm going to visit Trantor so as I can get background material on the First Empire, you know? I was born on Trantor, did you know that?" He did, but he said, "You were," and put just the right amount of amazement into his voice. He was rewarded with something between a beam and a simper. "Uh-huh. My grandmother, you know, Beta Daryl, you've heard of her, was on Trantor once with my grandfather. In fact, that's where they stopped the mule, when all the galaxy was at his feet. And my father and mother went there also when they were first married. I was born there. I even lived there till Mother died, only I was just 3 then, and I don't remember much about it. Were you ever on Trantor, Uncle Homier?" "No, can't say I was." He leaned back against the cold bulkhead and listened idly. Kalgan was very close, and he felt his uneasiness flooding back. "Isn't it just the most romantic world? My father says that under Stanil the Fifth, it had more people than any 10 worlds nowadays. He says that it was just one big world of metals, one big city that was the capital of all the galaxy. He's shown me pictures that he took on Trantor. It's all in ruins now, but it's still stupendous. I just love to see it again. In fact, Homier..."
"Yes?"
"Why don't we go there when we've finished with Kalgan?" Some of the fright hurtled back into his face. "What? Now don't start on that. This is business, not pleasure. Remember that." "But it is business," she squeaked. "There might be incredible amounts of information on Trantor. Don't you think so?" "No, I don't." He scrambled to his feet.
Now untangle yourself from the computer. We've got to make the last jump, and then you turn in. One good thing about landing, anyway. He was about fed up with trying to sleep on an overcoat on the metal floor. The calculations were not difficult. The Space Route Handbook was quite explicit on the Foundation Kalgan route. There was the momentary twitch of the timeless passage through hyperspace, and the final light year dropped away. The sun of Kalgan was a sun now, large, bright, and yellow-white, invisible behind the portholes that had automatically closed on the sunlit side. Kalgan was only a night's sleep away. Chapter 12. Lord. Of all the worlds on the galaxy, Kalgan undoubtedly had the most unique history. That of the planet Terminus, for instance, was that of an almost uninterrupted rise. That of Trantor, once capital of the galaxy, was that of an almost uninterrupted fall. But Kalgan... Kalgan first gained fame as the pleasure world of the galaxy, 2 centuries before the birth of Harry Seldon. It was a pleasure world in the sense that it made an industry, and an immensely profitable one at that, out of amusement. And it was a stable industry. It was the most stable industry in the galaxy. When all the galaxy perished as a civilization, little by little, scarcely a feather's weight of catastrophe fell upon Kalgan. No matter how the economy and sociology of the neighboring sectors of the galaxy changed, there was always an elite, and it is always the characteristic of an elite that it possesses leisure as the great reward of its elitehood. Kalgan was at the service, therefore, successively and successfully, of the effete and perfumed dandies of the imperial court, with their sparkling and libidinous ladies, of the rough and raucous warlords who ruled in iron the worlds they had gained in blood, with their unbridled and lascivious wenches, of the plump and luxurious businessmen of the Foundation, with their lush and flagitious mistresses. It was quite undiscriminating, since they all had money, and since Kalgan serviced all and barred none, since its commodity was in unfailing demand, since it had the wisdom to interfere in no world's politics, to stand on no one's legitimacy. It prospered when nothing else did, and remained fat when all grew thin. That is, until the mule. Then, somehow, it fell too, before a conqueror who was impervious to amusement, or to anything but conquest. To him, all planets were alike, even Kalgan. So, for a decade, Kalgan found itself in the strange role of galactic metropolis, mistress of the greatest empire since the end of the galactic empire itself. And then, with the death of the mule, as sudden as the zoom, came the drop. The Foundation broke away. With it and after it, much of the rest of the Mule's dominions. 50 years later, there was left only the bewildering memory of that short space of power, like an opium dream. Kalgan never quite recovered. It could never return to the unconcerned pleasure world it had been, for the spell of power never quite releases its hold. It lived instead under a succession of men whom the Foundation called the Lords of Kalgan, but who styled themselves First Citizen of the Galaxy, in imitation of the Mule's only title, and who maintained the fiction that they were conquerors too. The current Lord of Kalgan had held that position for 5 months. He had gained it originally by virtue of his position at the head of the Kalganian Navy, and through a lamentable lack of caution on the part of the previous Lord. Yet no one on Kalgan was quite stupid enough to go into the question of legitimacy too long or too closely. These things happened, and are best accepted. Yet that sort of survival of the fittest, in addition to putting a premium on bloodiness and evil, occasionally allowed capability to come to the fore as well. Lord Stettin was competent enough, and not easy to manage. Not easy for His Eminence the First Minister, who, with fine impartiality, had served the last Lord as well as the present, and who would, if he lived long enough, serve the next as honestly. Nor easy for Lady Kalia, who was Stettin's more than friend, yet less than wife. In Lord Stettin's private apartments, the three were alone that evening. The First Citizen, bulky and glistening in the Admiral's uniform that he affected, scowled out from the unupholstered chair, in which he sat as stiffly as the plastic of which it was composed. His First Minister, Lev Mirus, faced him with a far-off unconcern, his long, nervous fingers stroking absently and rhythmically the deep line that curved from hooked nose along gaunt and sunken cheek to the point, nearly, of the gray-bearded chin. The Lady Calia disposed of herself gracefully on the deeply furred covering of a fomite couch, her full lips trembling a bit in an unheeded pout. "Sir," said Miras, it was the only title adhering to a lord who was styled only First Citizen, "you lack a certain view of the continuity of history. Your own life, with its tremendous revolutions, leads you to think of the course of civilization as something equally amenable to sudden change. But it is not. The mule showed otherwise. But who can follow in his footsteps? He was more than a man, remember. And he, too, was not entirely successful." "Poochie," whimpered the Lady Calia, suddenly, and then shrank into herself at the furious gesture from the First Citizen. Lord Stetton said harshly, "Do not interrupt, Calia. Miras, I am tired of inaction. My predecessor spent his life polishing the Navy into a finely turned instrument that has not its equal in the galaxy. And he died with the magnificent machine lying idle. Am I to continue that? I, an admiral of the Navy? How long before the machine rusts? At present, it is a drain on the treasury and returns nothing. Its officers long for dominion, its men for loot. All Kalgan desires the return of empire and glory. Are you capable of understanding that? These are but words that you use, but I grasp your meaning. Dominion, loot, glory, pleasant when they are obtained. But the process of obtaining them is often risky and always unpleasant. The first fine flush may not last. And in all history, it has never been wise to attack the foundation. Even the mule would have been wiser to refrain." There were tears in the Lady Calia's blue, empty eyes. Of late, Poochie scarcely saw her. And now, when he had promised the evening to her, this horrible, gray, thin man, who always looked through her rather than at her, had forced his way in. And Poochie let him. She dared not say anything, was frightened even of the sob that forced its way out. But Stetton was speaking now in the voice she hated, hard and impatient. He was saying, "You're a slave to the far past. The Foundation is greater in volume and population, but they are loosely knit and will fall apart at a blow. What holds them together these days is merely inertia, an inertia I am strong enough to smash. You are hypnotized by the old days, when only the Foundation had atomic power. They were able to dodge the last hammer blows of the dying empire, and then faced only with the unbrained anarchy of the warlords, who would counter the Foundation's atomic vessels only with hulks and relics. But the mule, my dear Miras, has changed that. He spread the knowledge that the Foundation had hoarded to itself through half the galaxy, and the monopoly in science is gone forever. We can match them." "And the Second Foundation?" questioned Miras coolly. "And the Second Foundation," replied Stetton as coolly. "Do you know its intentions? It took 10 years to stop the mule, if indeed it was the factor which some doubt. Are you unaware that a good many of the Foundation psychologists and sociologists are of the opinion that the Selden plan has been completely disrupted since the days of the mule? If the plan has gone, then a vacuum exists which I may fill as well as the next man. Our knowledge of these matters is not great enough to warrant the gamble. Our knowledge, perhaps. But we have a Foundation visitor on the planet. Did you know that? A Homer Munn, who I understand has written articles on the mule, and has expressed exactly that opinion, that the Selden plan no longer exists." The First Minister nodded. "I have heard of him, or at least of his writings. What does he desire?" "He asks permission to enter the mule's palace." "Indeed, it would be wise to refuse. It is never advisable to disturb the superstitions with which a planet is held. I will consider that, and we will speak again." Miras bowed himself out. Lady Calia said tearfully, "Are you angry with me, Poochie?" Stetton turned on her savagely. "Have I not told you before never to call me by that ridiculous name in the presence of others?"
"You used to like it."
"Well, I don't anymore, and it is not to happen again." He stared at her darkly. It was a mystery to him that he tolerated her these days. She was a soft, empty-headed thing, comfortable to the touch, with a pliable affection that was a convenient facet to a hard life. Yet even that affection was becoming wearisome. She dreamed of marriage,
of being first lady. Ridiculous. She was all very well when he had been...